In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, the UK's best-selling history magazine. I'm David Musgrove. And welcome back to the third of our four-part podcast mini-series, a medieval masterclass with the historian Dan Jones. This was first recorded as a virtual lecture programme in the late summer of 2021, when Dan's book, Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages, had just been published. And over the course of four episodes, I asked Dan to take us on a journey through the four ages of medieval history from the collapse of the Western Roman Empire through to the dawning of Renaissance ideas and religious revolution. So in the first two sessions that you've already heard, we covered a fair bit of ground. We started in the 5th century and we got up to the early 13th century. This time we're going to be lasering in on a much shorter period of time, 1215 to 1347, and the title of today's session is Rebirth. So to recap, in our last session, we finished up talking about the Crusades and the changing geopolitical situation that resulted from the development of the Crusader kingdoms in the Holy Land. Now we're going to have another big geopolitical shift with the rise of the Mongols. And when Dan does his overview of the period in just a second, he will start off with the Mongols, and that's what you'll hear next. And then after his introduction, he and I will dissect some of those key themes in a bit more detail. And just a reminder, if you want to watch the video of our conversation and enjoy the extended original audience Q&A that we had in the live masterclass session, you can do that at our website at historyextra.com/video, though you do need to be a website subscriber to access that content. So anyway, over to Dan to introduce us to the Age of Rebirth, 1215 to 1347.
When I conceived this book, Powers and Thrones, one of the questions I wanted to pose and to answer, hopefully, was what were the natures of power in the Middle Ages? What were the powers? Now, in the past, I'd written dynastic histories like the Plantagenets, where the study of power was essentially political and constitutional, exercised through monarchies. I'd written books about the Templars and Crusaders, in which power was still somewhat political, but also expressed in military terms and in faith terms. But I was conscious that that's actually quite a narrow vision of any society, including medieval society, including the Middle Ages. And what I've really wanted to do in Powers and Thrones, and that's why that little S is there, is to explore the multitude of different powers that shaped the medieval world. And that's what this section of the book and this episode of this masterclass is going to do. We're going to range across quite a lot of territory. I mean that geographically as well as thematically. We talked in the first masterclass about the inheritance of Rome. And I posed the idea that in the early Middle Ages, it was the forces of Islam, the first Islamic caliphates, the rise of the Arabs, that this was the military power, the imperial power that had the best claim to be the true inheritors of the Roman Empire in the West, in the Mediterranean world. And that certainly, I think, holds, I believe that holds true for the early Middle Ages. But by the time we get to the later Middle Ages, the 12th and 13th centuries, there are new powers, military powers at large in the world. And the greatest of those is the Mongols, the Mongol Empire, established by Genghis or Chinggis Khan around the turn of the 12th into the 13th century, expanded at extraordinary, at breakneck speed by Chinggis Khan, by his generals, by his sons, and then by the successor Khans, such that by the middle of the 13th century, by the 1250s, 1260s, the Mongols are indisputably a global superpower. They've assembled the biggest contiguous land empire that the world had seen to that point, and they briefly, for a couple of generations, held it together before that empire split into four with power blocks across what's now China, Central Asia, Persia, and southern Russia into Eastern Europe. The legacy of the Mongols to the medieval world was enormous, and the effect that the Mongols had on the medieval imagination, particularly in Western Europe. Now, the Mongols never made it to Rome and Paris, although the Mongol Khans were often keen to suggest that if they fancied it, they just might. They never made it into Western Europe. However, there was a deep fascination with the Mongols, and that was tinged with apprehension of the Mongols on the part of Christian kings. There was also an enduring and pervasive fantasy among popes and among kings that the Mongols were somehow the fulfillment of a prophecy, the prophecy of King David, or possibly of Prester John, this faraway king just over the horizon who either was Christian or might be converted to Christianity and who could be persuaded to join forces with the crusading Western powers of Western Europe and the Mediterranean world, and these two could go and crush between them the forces of the Islamic world, who provided the bulk of the opposition in the Near and Middle East during the crusading period. The Mongols also, by virtue of their merciless tactics in conquest and the sheer size of their conquests, established what's sometimes called the Pax Mongolica. So this is similar to the Pax Romana or the Pax Britannica. It's the idea that an enormous empire provides a peace within its borders, no matter how fiercely or ferociously or pitilessly or mercilessly this empire has been established. That once established and held, it provides a peace within its borders. And there was the sort of the trope, the myth about the Mongol Empire was that a woman could walk naked with a gold vase on her head from one end to the other and not be molested or robbed or mistreated in any way because of the fear of the inhabitants of the Mongol Empire held for the wrath of the Khans. Okay, so The first power that we're going to discuss in this masterclass is really the greatest military imperial power of the later Middle Ages, arguably of the whole Middle Ages. That's the Mongols. Now, from there, we're going to shift our focus somewhat thematically, because the next three chapters of Powers and Thrones, which follow on from the Mongols, are entitled Merchants, Scholars, and Builders. These are all chapters about the ways that power can be expressed in terms that are not solely military. And we'll get into the weeds of what that means, I think, as the masterclass goes on. What I'd say is that they follow each other somewhat sequentially. So the chapter about merchants begins with Marco Polo, and we can trace a line from the establishment of the Mongol Empire to an increasing interest in and busyness in trade between the Mediterranean world and the Far East, which was aided by the stability that a large Mongol empire gave across the Silk Road. But the chapter about merchants and the study of merchants in the later Middle Ages takes in far more than simply trade networks between the West and the Far East. It's also about the rising sophistication and the growing sophistication of financial institutions, financial instruments, companies, merchant banks, organizations that can facilitate credit transfer across borders. All of these in the 12th and 13th century began to really gain momentum, and the medieval world developed an economic sophistication that it had lacked since arguably the fall of Rome, and an interconnectedness as well. So we can talk about that, and I deeply hope that in the course of talking about medieval merchants, we'll get on to my pet favourite medieval figure of them all, who is Dick Whittington, the 15th century merchant extraordinaire and politician extraordinaire, who shows us how commercial power can actually be allied with political power, and these things can come together. The other two groups I want to talk about are scholars, because around the same time, the 12th and 13th centuries, see the rise in the West of the universities and a renewal in intellectual inquiry and philosophical inquiry and a sorting out of how new or revived interest in scholars from the ancient world, particularly such as Aristotle, how the revival of old learning could be squared with thinking about biblical texts and the dogma of the Latin Church. So we can think a little bit about that, because I think that the rise of the universities is one of the legacies of the medieval world, which we still feel very profoundly today. Last week, I was staying up in Cambridge because I was talking in Ely, and I stayed in my college, Pembroke, which was founded in 1347, just at the end of the period we're going to be discussing today. And I was filled with the sense as we were there that I was walking into a medieval institution, but there is an enormous sense of continuity in the oldest universities in this country and across Europe that dates back to the Middle Ages. And the first universities, Bologna, Oxford, Paris, really set a template that we are still, to a degree, operating within today. There is a continuous line back to the Middle Ages in the way that we think we organise learning at universities. And the final thing I want to talk about is building, because that, somewhat like what I've just been saying about universities, that is also something that links us very tangibly and visibly with the Middle Ages today. We can if we want to, as it were, step back in time and travel back to the Middle Ages, the best way perhaps to do it is to go and visit either a castle or a Gothic cathedral. And hundreds of thousands of people still do exactly that every year, because whilst it can be difficult to put ourselves in an abstract sense back into the Middle Ages and to try and understand and inhabit medieval worldviews, it's very easy to go and buy a ticket for £7 or £8 or whatever it costs and go into one of these buildings and experience some of what it was would have been like to walk on a specific geographical spot 500, 600, 700, 800, 900 years ago. So though that is the that's the scheme of the next 45 minutes or so. We're going to move from the greatest political military power, the greatest military power, I should say, through an exploration of other ways that power could operate in the medieval world, going from the commercial to the scholarly to the architectural.
First thing, I just want to clarify with you. Is it Genghis or Chinggis? What is this, a Boudica Boudicca thing? What's happening here? How should we refer to this guy?
I think if you want to, you get Chinggis Khan is how most scholars say it properly, but I'm a pragmatist in this regard, rather than strictly politically sensitive and correct. And I think that if you say Chinggis Khan, about half the time people go, huh, who? And you go, yeah, Genghis Khan, but you're supposed to say Chinggis Khan. So Genghis Khan, as you please, I don't mind.
Okay.
Other people do mind, but I don't.
Well, probably I'll probably just mix and match for a bit then, but I'll try not to. So this guy, this Chinggis Khan fella, obviously a very famous person. We all know about him. Just give us a bit of background. How did he come to power, and how did he come to power so quickly and build such an empire with such rapidity?
Well, in a way, Genghis Khan's story is one of the oldest in the world. It's of a poor boy born to tribal Mongolian society in or around 1160, whose family are cast out by the tribe for various reasons, and who then has to win his way back into favor. He's all sorts of... It's very hard to know with any great clarity what Genghis Khan... Temujin is his name before he becomes Genghis Khan, which means sort of very, very loosely Great Conqueror. It's very hard to know with much specificity really what the early life of Genghis Khan was all about. And that's because the secret history of the Mongols, which is the main source that we go to look for information about the rise of Temujin, Genghis Khan, is suffused with legend and also quite cryptic. However, the bare bones of the story are this. A poor boy, cast out from society, makes his way back in, and rises through, I mean, this genuinely seems to be a rise through force of personality to the head of tribal society by drawing people to him, organizing them, fighting other tribes within the Mongolian world, but then having the wherewithal to bring those he defeated and who accepted or assented to his leadership with him in building a larger and larger and larger and larger coalition, until by around the time of, by the sort of midpoint of his life, he had become fairly unassailably and unquestionably the strong man of Mongolian society and had been awarded the title Genghis Khan. There are certain things he does that enable him to hold together a Mongolian tribal society in a way that had not hitherto been possible. And a lot of those are administrative. Instead of organizing his military forces simply by allying different tribal groups, he institutes a completely new organizational system in the army based on units, decimal units of troops, with loyalty to him personally as the highest quality to be most rewarded, and with draconian dread punishments for anyone who steps out of line. And draconian dread punishments for anyone who steps out of line is the absolute bedrock of Mongolian conquest into the 13th century all the way up to 1260. And although their armies are never enormous, they're extraordinarily well-disciplined, they're meritocratic, and they are brutal. They're brutal to the point of absolutely destroying anybody and anything that stands in their way or offers any defiance. However, they're also open-minded in the sense that if you immediately bow down and accept Mongol authority, you will be drawn within the Mongol world. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is to be debated, but you won't be immediately slaughtered at any rate, and you'll be allowed to keep your life, even if your life changes rapidly. All of that really, I think, stems from the character and the worldview of Genghis Khan himself. And even after Genghis Khan's death, there is still the sort of DNA of what he'd been about is retained within the Mongol military machine and the Mongol imperial machine.
So that's interesting, because we've seen a sort of few examples in the course of our discussions thus far of people whose personalities allow for something to happen in their lifetime, but then it kind of falls away afterwards. But in this case, it seems that he is able to establish a bit of a legacy, and the empire that he establishes like really, really quickly does then last after him for a century or so, isn't it? So how does that happen? But does he institute that, some sort of cultural legacy, sort of he imbues with the people that follows him?
Yes, I think that's probably right. I think the effect of, well, there are several things going on. So on a personal level, and I think we do have to sometimes in history consider the powerful personality of an individual given the right circumstances. Is still, I believe, a moving historical factor. I know it goes in and out of fashion as to whether and the great man theory really exists. But I think if you look across history as a whole, you see extraordinary characters, from Alexander the Great to Augustus to or Julius Caesar, Augustus, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun. All the way through to modern tyrants, Stalin, Hitler, Mao, before them Napoleon. You do see, unquestionably throughout history, you do see individuals of powerful, if not admirable, character warp the shape of history. And I think it's perverse to ignore that. It also would be perverse to say that sheer force of character alone is enough to get anything done. In the case of the Mongols, and in the case of Genghis Khan, I think what allows this particular man to rise through Mongol tribal society is the fact that tribal society is weighted towards the influence of great men. But Genghis Khan does something quite interesting, which is he uses this force of personality and this cult of individual leadership, and then changes the way that Mongol, certainly military organization, but also tribal organization works. So he rises up through one system and then changes the system after him, sort of pulls the ladder up. So the system having been perfectly primed for him, he then amends, so it's sort of purely merit, or it's conceived as being purely meritocratic, very organizational rather than sort of tribes being locked together on an ad hoc basis. You have the organization of the army in groups of 10, groups of 100, groups of 1,000, and there is a clear, quite modern military structure to it, which is organized on, as I say, broadly meritocratic principles. And so I think that insight at the beginning is what creates a war machine, which then like many of the other imperial or imperializing war machines we've looked at in previous masterclasses, I'm thinking particularly of Charlemagne's armies. But this is true of other conquering powers throughout the medieval world. It thrives on expansion. So the more that the Mongol Empire expands, the more it can reward its troops. And the more it can reward its troops, the more troops it has, and the more it can expand. So it's an expansionist machine that just never stopped. Well, it takes a long time to stop expanding. It's the 1240s, you know. If Genghis Khan's born around 1160, it's the 1240s, even the 1250s, by the time the Mongols have reached the Hungarian steppe in one direction and they're sort of towards Korea in the other direction, and they've destroyed the Khwarazmians in Central Asia, and in 1258 have killed the Abbasid Caliph and burned half of Baghdad to the ground. And from the 1220s, rumours have been spreading around the Christian world that this is the great new coming superpower who's sort of almost heralds a complete step change in world history. So I think there's an organisational change with Genghis Khan. There's then a good run of imperial expansion. Part of which is founded on I mean, the mercilessness of Mongol tactics is something we should also consider, and the willingness in the course of conquest to use scorched earth tactics that few other powers in world history have ever been able to bring themselves to contemplate. You know, to ride up to a city and say, and this happens in, for example, in Merv. Say, are you going to surrender? And if the answer is no, then the city is immediately, everyone slaughtered, heads are piled up in gigantic piles outside, and the city may well be totally razed to the ground, so there's nothing left to be seen of it. Now, that serves as a warning to other cities that stand in the Mongols' path, surrender or die. It's a tactic that most advancing powers would not contemplate, because the thought of what's the point of winning a prize when you totally destroy it? But that's not within the Mongol mindset.
How extensive was the Mongol Empire?
Very, very large. The largest contiguous land empire ever known, from Korea, is its furthest western expanse, to all the way around the top of the Black Sea, into Eastern Europe, and there are Western Crusades called to defend the kingdoms of Poland and Hungary in the 1240s from Mongol attack. And it does look, there are periods in the 1240s and even the 1250s where it really looks like it's quite possible that Western Europe will fall, given an ill wind to the Mongols. And there are these very, very interesting exchanges of letters between, particularly in the 1250s, between Hulagu Khan, who's the Khan who takes Baghdad and rolls the Abbasid Caliph up in a carpet and has him trampled to death by horses. There is a great exchange of letters between him and Louis the Ninth, Saint Louis, King of France, sort of showing off to each other, and it's very clear, you know, which of these is the greater king. Now, Louis the Ninth is one of the great kings of France, but Hulagu Khan writes to him in sort of friendly terms, but the imperiousness of the tone that he takes with this king somewhere over there in the West, and his scorn towards all other non-Mongol leaders. I think he refers to the Mamluks, you know, slave soldier dynasty that had risen out of Egypt, had swept through the Islamic world, were the sort of power, the great threat that would bring down the Crusader states shortly afterwards. And Hulagu Khan dismisses them as Babylonian dog mice, which I think is a real burn. And I think that of course, I mean, that's natural, because by the time Hulagu Khan is on the scene, it's two generations into Mongol expansion, and it just seems like they're going to take over the entire world. Why wouldn't they? They've been doing it for 60 years. It's all people like Hulagu Khan have ever known. There's no reason why they should stop where they've stopped. So that territorial expansion is an enormous degree of what gives people like Hulagu Khan their confidence.
So what does happen, though? Why doesn't Britain become part of the Mongol Empire? Why is their advance stopped?
Well, because actually, I'm not going to say that their luck runs out, but there are lots of theories about why suddenly, having looked like they're into Hungary, into the Balkans possibly, into Poland, that they're just going to keep going. Suddenly, in the 1240s, they kind of turn around and or that it just seems to stop. Now, part of the reason is probably actually territorial overreach, because, of course, if you're the British Empire in the 19th century, in the age of the telegraph, it's just about possible to communicate between, let's say, London and Delhi, or London and, you know, the colonies in the war in Southern Africa or whatever. In the Middle Ages, communication, even with, so now the Mongols invent a very rapid postal system. Even given that, communication is necessarily difficult between the Mongol capital in what's now Beijing and, I don't know, Legnica, which is where there's a big battle in the 1240s between the Mongols and the Christian powers of Eastern Europe. So so the sheer size eventually becomes unsustainable. There are arguments that the grasslands of the Hungarian steppe are simply insufficient to feed the number of horses. So the Mongol army is cavalry, effectively. It's insufficient to feed that number of horses, and they realise there's also a change in power in the Mongol Empire, which demands that, which has been argued that it demands that a lot of Mongol leaders have to go home and witness the transfer of power. So quite what balance those factors, what weight we give to those different factors in assessing the sort of end of the period of Mongol expansion is hard to say. But soon after that, but I think it's probably overreach. I think actually there is a limit to the size of the empire that you can, and we'd seen this with Rome. We'd seen this with Rome at the beginning of the period. You know, Rome got so big that you had this sort of peak Rome moment, kind of Trajan, Hadrian era. And then it's unsustainable. You end up having to have this thing partitioned and have Rome on the one hand, Constantinople on the other, and sometimes more capitals even than that. So that's kind of the story of imperial expansion, full stop. So I think you know the mass just becomes too big, and soon after the 1240s, you see effectively a partition of the Mongol Empire into these four great chunks that then go their own way. You know, you have the Ilkhanate centered on Persia, which becomes Islamic in character. You have the Great Yuan in China, which becomes much more, you know, essentially Chinese rather than Mongolian, and so on. The Golden Horde in Russia, Crimea, that sort of area. And they all take on the somewhat different forms and eventually fall to squabbling with one another. So I think size is probably just too big for your boots, if you like.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Because by the early 14th century, the institutional confidence of the of universities in general and the respect that they commanded in society had become such that their opinion counted. That, I mean, this was respectable opinion.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner.
Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Let's talk about this concept of the Pax Mongolica. It's an interesting thing. To nick a phrase from another period, what did the Mongols do for us?
Well, if we're looking at the Mongol expansion from the West, so rather than looking at it from the Mongol point of view, but if you're looking at it from the West, it's kind of interesting. The first whispers of Mongol expansion, the coming of the Mongols, sort of crop up around the 1221 mark during the Fifth Crusade. So the Fifth Crusaders in 1221 are down and trying to take Damietta in the Nile Delta and not having a particularly good time of it. And they're there for ages, and it's a bit of a relentless siege that doesn't end especially well. Put the details of the Fifth Crusade aside. What's important is that during the Fifth Crusade, these whispers start to filter through that out there over the horizon in the east is King David Prester John, one of these mythical Christian warriors who's coming. And so, and this seems a great boon and a great positive. And immediately people start thinking, well, how are we going to get in touch with this King David, who's conquering everyone before that goes before him? How can we take advantage of this? This must be a good thing, right? You know, it's a great military power that is potentially an ally for the force of the Crusaders against the Ayyubids, in this case, Al-Kamil, Saladin's nephew. Of course, it doesn't turn out like that at all, but there is still this initial sense that this what turns out to be a rapidly expanding Eastern Empire controlled by the Mongols is going to be a good thing. There are wobbles in the 1240s, as we already said, when it looks like that actually this is going to be very, very dangerous indeed for the West, for Europe. By the 1260s, there's a sort of pragmatism which again sees the Mongols as potentially allies to save the Crusader states from the Mamluks. So that's the first part of it, that this expanding empire looks, particularly from a Crusader perspective, like it might just be a good thing. It might be a positive if you can handle the Mongols correctly and maybe convert them to Christianity. But the other interesting thing to look at is the trade implications of the Mongol Empire. Because around the time, so 1260s, when the Mongol Empire has sort of reaching its territorial peak, there's a revolution in Constantinople. Now, in Constantinople, in 1204, the Fourth Crusaders had deposed the Byzantine emperor and placed a Latin emperor of Constantinople on the throne. That process is reversed in the 1260s, and there's a Greek Byzantine restoration in Constantinople. And that causes significant problems for trade because Latin Western traders are, there's a bloody revenge is being taken against them. Now, in Powers and Thrones, the way I've illustrated that is through the fortunes of the Polo family, Niccolo, Maffeo Polo, and the most famous of the Polos, Marco Polo, because ambitious traders from the rising Italian merchant city republics, places like Venice, like Pisa, like Genoa, start to see the rise of the Mongols as good for business. And this is where the travels of Marco Polo is a very interesting source, because the travels of Marco Polo, is one of these adventurous merchants who goes out, the Venetian merchant who goes out to the court of the Khan and stays there for 25 years, traveling around the Mongol Empire. Now, this is where we get a view of what the Pax Mongolica actually looks like or what it does. This is sort of crass modern analogy, really. but it's a gigantic free trade zone, effectively. And it guarantees trade, or it stabilizes trade across a vast territorial expanse. And so Marco Polo, when he's in the service of the Khans, is able to travel around observing. He works for the Khans, but there are Western traders at work in the Mongol Empire, and trade is going back and forth between East and West during the Mongol Empire, during the high points of the Mongol Empire. And the most interesting thing about the travels is for me, are the commercial notes that Marco Polo takes while he's in the 25 years in the service of the Khans, because he sees, you know, the best of everything. He knows where the best place to get, you know, dried mango sweets is. He knows where the best place to buy horses is. He knows the best place to buy this cloth and that cloth. And he gives you the sense of the vastness of the Mongol Empire, really containing everything under the sun. And he's greedily interested in it to an extent as an aspiring Venetian merchant, or certainly the member of an aspiring Venetian merchant family.
And so basically, as you sort of outline in your book, it's kind of Marco Polo's work is a book of trade secrets and tips, isn't it, for people who want to flog stuff around the world. And that's quite interesting because it ties us into the next theme, the next chapter of your book, the commercial side of things, the commercial revolution, which is a sort of a historical concept. You just mentioned those Italian city-states. We haven't really heard much about them. How have they come into the picture? Where do they appear from, and how do they foster this new interest in commerce?
We could start the story of them in a number of different points. By the time of the First Crusade, so the late 11th century, the Venetians, Genoans, and Pisans, with Genoese and Pisans, have, because particularly of their seafaring abilities and their geographical location on the coasts of northern Italy, looking, you know, east and west, they've started to exercise a high degree of political power despite their tiny territorial footprint. And as the later Middle Ages unfold, you start to see Genoa, Venice, Pisa, Florence, Amalfi, among others, as serious players in the Mediterranean world. So despite their tiny territorial size, as compared to, let's say, the kingdoms of England or France or whatever, they are the sort of rampaging capitalists, as it were, of the medieval world, and that gives them enormous power. And they have strategic trading posts or colonies around the world. Now, one of the reasons, this draws them heavily into the Crusade. So, from the First Crusade right through to the end of the Crusader states, you see very, very heavy interest on the part of the Italian city republics in maintaining a Crusader presence in the Near East, on the, you know, the coastal littoral of what's now Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, because this is hyper sensitive commercial space, and within cities like Acre or Tyre, Jaffa, Jerusalem's port, you always see little Italian colonies where they'll have trading privileges, and they will bring fighting men. They'll have fighting galleys in order to defend those cities in order to keep their commercial position. There are also Italian merchant colonies in Constantinople, usually when conditions allow, and in the ports like Kaffa in the Black Sea. And that enables a sort of like chain of trading posts to operate from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea, and joining up with Silk Road routes, which will then enable them to import spices and cloth from the Far East. So from about the 11th century, And certainly by the 12th and 13th century, they are extraordinarily powerful players. And we should also include Florence, which isn't a maritime power, but Florence becomes incredibly important as a banking power.
Let's pick up on that, because as you talk about in your book, Florence is kind of the center of a lot of banking activity. And I suppose that leads us into talking about the innovative financial instruments that were developed to enable these commercial players to operate in an environment when actual physical travel took a long time, particularly, you know, when you've got this vast distance that you might be wanting to track goods across. They introduced new methods which allowed them to not have to physically move from place to place, but whereby they could move their resources and their money to make best advantage of what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, so you see, well, a good example to illustrate this and one that I use in the book is the case of England. So England's involvement with Italian banks in the 13th and 14th century is a super interesting way of seeing how sophisticated the medieval economy gets in the 12th and 13th century. So what's England good at in the 12th and 13th century? Well, what does it produce? Well, its biggest export commodity is wool. England's a great place to graze sheep. And there are lots of monasteries, lots of particularly Cistercian monasteries, where sheep grazing is big business. Exporting wool for manufacture into cloth, often in Flanders, and then that cloth will then be sold in Italy often, but in other markets around Europe. This is such enormous business that the crown maintains a very, very close interest in the import-export of wool sacks. It's always a huge part of government revenue, taxing wool sacks as they go out of the country. And inevitably, it becomes interesting to other rich merchants around Europe. Now, think about the practicalities for a second. If you want to buy wool, turn it into cloth and sell it, buy English wool and sell it and sell the cloth manufactured from it in Italy, that requires, in an age without easy credit transfer and the internet and stuff, quite a lot of moving, or it could require quite a lot of moving stuff around and moving people around and moving salesmen around. But what develops in Italy, and particularly in Florence during the 12th and 13th century, is a growing financial and commercial institutions and instruments which make this all much easier. The formation of companies, you have the development of insurance, and you have you start to have mechanisms for credit transfer without actually moving coin from one place to the other. So an Italian bank that's interested in the trade between wool and cloth in Flanders, England, and Italy, that triangle, a company like the Frescobaldi or the Bardi, these are big sort of merchant banks, are into this kind of trade, might have a situation where they advance money to an English crown that is eager to go and fight wars. So they might say, okay, well, we'll lend you the money up front, but we're going to take that out of, we're going to either take it in, part of it paid back in wool, or we'll take over the job of collecting the wool tax on behalf of the English crown, and we'll take some of the proceeds of that. They might also then double that up with subcontracting tax collecting duties in Italy from the Pope, and also having private banking customers in Italy, so they can move money around on paper without actually moving it around very much physically. So you start to get this really quite sophisticated transactions with. In England, you'll have an agent for the, you know, let's say the Frescobaldi or the Bardi or whichever bank is in favour and hasn't been bankrupted by dud loans, not repaid by the English crown, in situ, in positions of quite high political influence within England, And they'll be keeping in contact with agents from the same company in Italy and in Flanders in order to do the deals that moves the money, moves the cloth around with the minimum of traveling by individuals and actually the minimum of traveling in goods either. And you have to start having the market, the cloth markets in Flanders, trading in futures, trading in the notion of I will buy wool at a certain price at a certain time and then laying off those trades. So things that, that we think of as probably quite modern financial transactions are at play and at work in the 12th and 13th centuries.
So it's interesting, actually, listening to you talk, we're hearing not so much about kings and potentates in this section, but more about merchants and commerce. And there's a line in your book, the commercial revolution placed power in the hands of new agents besides emperors, popes and kings. It allowed the merchants to assume a prominent place in medieval society and culture. So we've got money equating much more closely to power now, I guess, particularly in manifested in those Italian city-states where they're able to hold political power and do things above and beyond their size, as you said. Moving from money equating to power, what about knowledge equating to power and the rise of universities? So just drop us into this university story. When did they start to become important? Are they linked to this commercial revolution, or is that a separate development?
Well, they're somewhat linked geographically. They're somewhat linked by the fact that as you have a rising you have an increasingly sophisticated economy. You have an increasing needs for financial services and legal services. And so the origin, so the interesting institutional hyphen intellectual development in the later Middle Ages, the rise of the universities. In the 11th century, the first university is in Bologna. It's a law school, effectively, in Bologna. And one of the reasons that it's in Bologna is because Bologna sits sort of halfway between the papacy and the Holy Roman Emperors in Germany, who are constantly at each other's throats and, as well as fighting each other, suing each other. So you need lots of lawyers geographically in between those two groups. But after Bologna, you see the University of Paris, the University of Oxford, and then in the century or so after those are founded, you start to see universities springing up in most major cities across Western Europe. And the universities, as I say, Bologna specializes in law, but they exist to educate. That's higher education in the way almost that we think of it now. So there is, in the Middle Ages, and certainly in the later Middle Ages, this starts to become a career that is purely knowledge-based. Now, the need for highly educated people springs partly from the church, which needs literate clerics, partly from government bureaucracies, who need literate and numerate clerics, but partly from a growing sense that the pursuit of knowledge per se is beneficial to society, and that institutions that perform the business of teaching and expanding the frontiers of human knowledge are something that is worth having. And that's an idea that is fundamental to the way that Western society and the Western mind still operates today, even if there are constantly, in England at any rate, this constant sense that there are attacks on the whole idea of university as a place where you go to study rather than somewhere you go to just become an engineer and go and make things. And there, we do have this retained sense from the later Middle Ages that the pursuit of knowledge in universities is an important part of society. Now, allied to that in the later Middle Ages is also, and this ties into the Crusades, is also a flood back into Western Europe of the works of writers who hadn't really been seen in Western Europe for hundreds of years, and chief among them, Aristotle. Now, the sort of ancient Greek, the pagan philosophers had gone out of fashion at the end of the early Middle Ages, as knowledge became the monopoly of an increasingly narrow-minded Roman Catholic Church. And as knowledge was the preserve of monks in monasteries. Now, universities are still heavily Christian organizations. And if you think about an Oxbridge College today, of course it is. You know, the college was initially a college of priests. The college it was designed for churchmen to study. However, there is a growing appetite in the later Middle Ages for, or a growing comfort at any rate, for the works of pagan scholars. A lot of that, of their works, had been preserved in Islamic libraries and libraries in places like Cordoba, in central southern Spain, which fell into Christian hands during the Reconquista. So the advance of the Crusade in Spain and Portugal brought back under the control of Christian kings enormous libraries, and there's a translation movement where scholars rush to these libraries and start translating out of Arabic into Latin works that hadn't been seen for a long time, and studying them, and then trying to, and a big drive in scholarship in 12th and 13th centuries and 14th century, I suppose, as well, is the job of squaring the insights and the dialectical models and styles of argument from Aristotle and the ancients with the traditional interpretations of Christian scripture. How does all that manifest itself in power? Well, the example that I use in Powers and Thrones is the Templars. Now, the fall of the Templars, which is something I've written about at length elsewhere, in Paris, driven by the French crown at the start of the 14th century. It's a story that's been told by me and by others many times. Effectively, it's about the King of France and his ministers deciding they want to bring down the Knights Templar for various reasons. But in order to do that, they have to go through a judicial process in Paris and elsewhere. And in 1307-8, when they start to try and take the Templars down, one of the first organizations that William de Nogaret, Philip IV of France's leading minister, one of the first institutions he goes to in order to have a judgment, a sort of pre-judgment pronounced against the Templars, which he thinks will be damning to the order, is the University of Paris. Because by the early 14th century, the institutional confidence of universities in general and the respect that they commanded in society had become such that their opinion counted. That, I mean, this was respectable opinion. So the story really of the rise of the universities is institutionalizing knowledge outside the sort of ad hoc studies of individual monks in monasteries, with a teaching function, with the purpose of providing and making bureaucrats, with the purpose of providing and making thinkers per se, but which very quickly creates these institutions that have high social prestige and whom you turn to when you want a sort of degree of certainty about something that you're doing politically. And that, for me, is an interesting form of power that is that goes beyond the pursuit of knowledge in and of itself.
As we said before, your book is in a way a meditation on power and how power is manifested. And two of the biggest, most obvious symbols of power that still remain to us today from the Middle Ages are buildings, castles, and cathedrals. So tell us about those. How were they used by the people in power to demonstrate their power, and how do they fit into this bigger picture of the changing and perhaps more slightly sophisticated nature of society as we move into this period?
Yeah, well, one of the ways that we manifest power, or have manifested power as humans throughout the ages, is through buildings. And if you think about the sort of the skyscraper race in, I don't know, petrodollar rich Gulf states today, you know, the sense they're going to have first, you've got the Burj Al Khalifa, you know, the gigantic one in Dubai, and then Saudi are building the Saudi Tower, which is going to be a kilometer high. It's a really elemental way of expressing wealth, and through wealth, power. And that's no different in the Middle Ages. And the two most iconic types of building that remain with us from the Middle Ages are castles and cathedrals. And although I've tried to, you know, I have in Powers and Thrones spread the view of the Middle Ages far beyond England, which was the country I wrote about a lot in my earlier books. I think it is to, you can return quite profitably to England to look at how buildings are used to manifest power. So let's take castles. If we look at Edward I, Edward Longshanks, Hammer of the Scots, in power from the 1270s through the first to 1307, pursues a military project which amounts to the subjugation of the whole of the British Isles, or the attempted subjugation of the whole of the British Isles, and it's ruled by the English crown. The Scottish Wars of Independence are one thing, but the most successful part probably of this drive of Edward's to extend the power of the English crown across the whole the British Isles is in Wales, where he captures and executes the last Prince of Wales, last native Prince of Wales, and then in order to stamp his authority on particularly on Snowdonia, traditionally the hardest part of Wales for English kings to venture into, let alone control, he builds that incredible ring of stone castles, many of which still stand more or less complete, or complete in the form that they were, the builders stopped working on them today. So I'm thinking about Beaumaris, Conwy, Rutland, Carnarvon, and so on, Flint. All of these castles along, sort of around Snowdonia in northern Wales, they serve two purposes. In one sense, they are military installations designed to garrison troops, designed to actually hold that territory for the English crown. But they go way beyond that in their architectural conception. And so these are not just garrisons for troops. These are gigantic statements of English power designed, you know, the engineer architect who oversees the project, Master James of St. George, Edward's favourite architect, has this monumental vision of how power can be stamped onto the landscape, scarred into the landscape. And if you go to, I mean, Carnarvon is my favourite of all those castles. If you go there today, it still dominates. It dominates the town, it dominates that part of the world. It's architecturally supposed to evoke the old walls of Constantinople. It was, you know, it was the place that Edward I sent his wife, Eleanor of Castile, to give birth to his youngest son and eventual successor, Edward II. So it has this sort of power in the imagination as well as in its architecture. That's a secular form of architecture as power. We see the same across England and indeed across the whole of Western Europe, excluding, not excluding Italy, but Italy's slightly different, with the movement to Gothic cathedrals as well. You know, this turn in the 12th, 13th centuries towards building very, very, very high. Somewhere I'm going next week when I'm speaking up in Lincoln, I always go when I go to Lincoln, is Lincoln Cathedral, once the tallest building in the world, taller than even the Great Pyramids in Egypt until its spire fell down in the 16th century, I think. And we've got dozens of them across England, and let alone all those that are in France, these enormous, soaring cathedrals in which the technology, because of buttresses on the outside, allows walls to be extremely thin, very, very high, and you can put these huge sheets of stained glass in them designed to evoke heaven on earth. This, again, is an expression of power, not so much the military secular power that you see expressed in Edward I's castles, but in the power of the church and it in its majesty, in its wealth, in its all-governing spiritual magnificence. And these things are still with us today, and they are, in a way, the most tangible, the most relatable relics of the whole medieval world. And so if we're thinking about power over time, I don't think there's anything stronger and more immediately comprehensible than castles and cathedrals.
You've been listening to Dan Jones, who is the author of Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages. And as a reminder, if you'd like to watch the video and the extended audience Q&A of this session, then you can do that at our website, historyextra.com/video, though you will need to be a subscriber to the site to be able to access that content. And the final episode in our masterclass series is on Revolution, AD 1348 to 1527. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Conley. To find more of our history content and podcast, go to historyextra.com.